Greetings. Welcome to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle, a podcast about movies and wine. For those of you who don't know shit about one or both of those topics, I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. My co-host Jamie is the wine guy. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves. We'll tell you and each other why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find that the pairing works. Sometimes we do not. Sometimes we find that we don't even get to the pairing in the first hour of the episode. So last week, we went extremely long talking about the movie half of things, The Matrix, 1999's all-time great classic iconic The Matrix. Today, we are going to be going equally long on the wine side of our show. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to past me and past Jamie and their conversation about Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc, already in progress. So, Jamie, as much as I do just want to talk about The Matrix, basically to myself today, and you can be here if you want to.
Right.
We should also talk about a wine.
Yes.
Have you thought about a wine that we might pair with The Matrix?
I thought long and hard about what wine to pair with The Matrix, and I'm really excited to announce that I chose Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc Vintage 2020. This is a wine that most people will have heard of, even if you are not in the wine world. It is pretty ubiquitous. It's on basically every shelf everywhere. It is the progenitor of the, or one of maybe five progenitors of the idea of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. And it's fucking delicious.
Every shelf everywhere?
Basically every shelf everywhere.
Okay, but I've never heard of it before.
Well, you are not that bright.
But
first
you,
of all.
But you think non-wine people will have heard of this wine.
They definitely have.
But I'm non-wine people, and I haven't heard of this.
Right. But you're exceptional in many ways, Scott.
Thank you.
Both good and bad.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
As long as I'm exceptional in the ways that I'm bad. But so, like, how have I missed this all these years?
I really don't know. Like, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc broadly and this wine specifically have just been everywhere, particularly since the 2003 acquisition of this company by LVMH.
Well, that does largely overlap with my drinking years.
Yep.
I mean, I've had New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc before. I've even had Marlborough region wines before.
Yep. But not this one specifically.
But I have not ever had this before.
You know, it definitely occupies a space in the market that maybe we missed in our come up.
Yeah. I mean, I was drinking garbage in much of my drinking years.
Yeah. And as I'll talk about a little in this episode and a little bit in our next episode, one of the hallmarks of New Zealand wine is overall quality. There is little to no plonk that gets made in New Zealand.
All right. This is a technical term that hasn't come up on the show before.
Plonk?
Plonk.
Yes.
What is plonk?
What does it sound like, man?
I mean, it sounds like you're saying plank, but wrong.
Plonk. You did it good. No, plonk. It's garbage. It's jug wine. Plonk is like whatever shit you just use to get drunk or to cook with.
And that's a wine term. That's a wine people term, is plonk.
It's like, I think, French in origin.
This isn't a Jamie-ism?
No.
P-L-A-N-K?
P-L-O-N-K.
Plonk is a non-specific and derogatory term used primarily in Commonwealth English for cheap, low-quality wine.
Ah, yeah, in British, that's right.
Despite the reference to the color white, the term is not limited to white wine and can as easily indicate a red wine or a rosé, according to Wikipedia. The featured photo is a takeout glass with what looks like iced tea in it.
That's plonk.
That is plonk. All right, we've all learned something.
We have.
Let us move on.
Moving right along.
Should we talk about this wine?
Should we talk about this wine?
That if you leave it in a cellar since 1995, it will turn to vinegar and thus be a one-star review.
I would be really interested, actually, to taste this wine aged. Not long ago, I had a 1997 Cloudy Bay Pinot Noir.
Mm.
That was delightful. Mm. Delicious. It was awesome. It had everything that I want from Pinot Noir. It was vibrant. It was gorgeous. I have a feeling that this wine, if properly cellared, would age. I don't know. It's obviously meant for immediate consumption. Like it is.
Obviously.
To me, obviously.
It's obvious to everyone.
It's you're baiting me right now.
No, it's very clear from drinking it that I'm supposed to drink this right now.
Are you doing, you're doing a sarcastic bit?
Right, no, now. I'm very sincere. Give me some more wine, and then wine. You should talk about the wine.
Why don't you talk about what you thought about the wine?
Do you think we could get that on microphone?
No. Better if I'm shouting it at you.
Right. It's better both for audio production purposes and for ease of listening.
Your audio production.
Right, but what about the audience?
The audience.
Boy, you heard it here first, y'all. Jamie says, you guys.
I do. Wow. And y'all honestly should have known that already.
Yeah. Well, you know, with these fucking $35 bottles of wine that you're picking out, you clearly 36. Don't, you don't give a shit about our audience.
Scotty, too hottie. I see you pulling out your Wine Folly notebook there.
Yeah.
That you love so well.
Well, it's very nice. And it has like a rubberized cover. And there's a little spot for my thoughts in here too.
Yeah.
And it's got the little red bookmark tassel.
Love those.
Very handsome.
Yep. Yeah. So what did you think of this wine?
Well, of the Cloudy Bay Sauvie B.
That's right.
Well, let me just go through here. So you can check my notes here. So the eyes feel that this is a white wine.
That is correct.
We would say it's a pale white wine. Would you say pale?
Pale.
Pale.
Yeah,
pale.
I would. If I was assessing this like blind tasting, I'd probably say pale straw.
Pale straw.
With hints of gold.
Mmm. Pale straw with hints of gold. Well, I marked it down as gold, but you're saying pale straw with hints of gold. Interesting. On the smell, on the schnuffer, very, very, very active bouquet on this one. Very enthusiastic nasal profile.
A high intensity of aromas.
Sure, you could say that too. I was getting pineapple on the schnuffer. Yeah. Some pineapple, some star fruit.
Getting that tropical fruit.
On the tasting notes here, I got... Be with me. This is very specific.
I'm here with you. I'm looking you in the face. I'm ready to hear what nut shit you're about to say.
It's like taking a bite out of a lemon.
Yeah.
It's not the lemon juice. It's not the lemon rind. It's not the pith or the pulp. It's all of it. All of those flavors and that rush of wetness. It's not dry.
It is dry.
Is it off dry at least? I marked that it was off dry.
It's fully dry.
All right. This is something I'm struggling with.
I know.
I feel that I can successfully detect when something is sweet, except that a lot of the things that I think are sweet are actually dry.
Yes.
So I'm good at identifying wines that are sweet, but I'm also good at identifying dry wines as sweet wines. So I guess I'm not actually good at identifying sweetness versus dryness at all.
You're not incorrectly identifying sweet wines as dry.
Yeah, so I'm like half-ish way there. But I think my complete failure to identify a dry wine.
It's hard. It legitimately is hard. Like, I want to make fun of you for it because that is my way.
And it's funny.
And it's funny.
And I don't mind because this is important to you. And it's funny to me that I don't care.
Dick. But so many of the descriptors that we use to talk about wine are sweet things.
Yeah.
Like fruit. But this has basically no sugar in it. It's all the way dry.
I'm very confused, but okay. My last tasting note, and this is the one that's actually buttshit weird. Starburst, the candy.
Hell yeah.
So a bite of a bite out of a lemon and then like a fistful of Starburst crammed into your mouth.
Do you have a particular color of Starburst that this is like for you?
It's kind of been a long time since I've had Starburst. I don't.
The pink is the best Starburst. That is an objective truth that we all know. And if you disagree, fuck off.
Well, there's what? There's a red, a pink, an orange, and a yellow.
That's correct.
Those are the colors
of Starburst. Those are the standard colors. I think that's all of them.
Yeah. Is there not a light green? There's no light green.
No.
No.
They do, like, the tropical ones have a light green, which I think is key.
Which are not traditional Starburst. No, I have no idea which color it is. Yellow. Let's say it's the yellow. Because I'm already saying lemony, citrusy.
Yeah, I would go with yellow.
Yeah. But those are my notes. I like it. It tastes good and I enjoyed it. So you should tell me about it because when we had our preliminary conversation about The Matrix and wine, you were fucking tickled by your own selection of this wine to go with The Matrix because you thought it might antagonize these like phantom wine people that you think are listening to the show waiting on bated breath for every fucking...
Probably anyone who's listening to this show are like wine people that typically agree with me. So they'll also be tickled by it.
But they're mostly listening for the movies because our audience has proven to us that it's about the movies.
God damn it. We're going to do another one of those polls at some point.
Well, we should probably get more followers.
Yeah, we're going to need more followers
at
some point. This is the archetypal New Zealand Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc. This was like a phenomenon. New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc didn't exist prior to the late 70s.
What did exist in New Zealand prior to then?
Sheep and wheat.
Table wines and fortified wines. That's what they grew there. I did some research, Jamie. And it wasn't just because I asked you for things and then you went to paywall websites and copied and pasted it and put it in a little conveniently but misformatted Word doc for me on Google Drive.
Whatever. I copied, pasted.
It's okay. I did some research. I read some things. Good. I remember some of them.
I am glad.
So they used to make a lot of fortified wines.
The word a lot is kind of a misnomer. It was most of their production, but their production was extraordinarily small. New Zealand wine wasn't really a factor on the world market. Part of the reason for that is the prohibition that happened in New Zealand, much like it happened in the United States, except it went on until 1967.
What?
In New Zealand.
Wow.
Yeah. From 1911 until 1967.
Wow.
And it wasn't full prohibition the way it was in America, meaning people could still drink sometimes. So it didn't spawn this like outrageous bootleg culture either. It basically just killed the industry. Like there was small amounts of drinking sometimes. They had a law called 6 o'clock swill. Bars had to close at 6 o'clock PM.
Wow.
Yeah.
What about working stiffs? When are they going to go to the bar?
They would literally get out of work at 5 o'clock, go and have a drink and be done.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's messed up, New Zealand.
It was what it was. They had a powerful temperance movement.
Well, I can't judge them too harshly.
Can't you?
No, because Jamie, that's where I've wanted to be the last 21 months has been in New Zealand.
Why's that? Why would you want to go to New Zealand?
Your sarcastic ignorance and indifference to things that pains me is really getting tiresome, pal. Yeah, why would I have wanted to go to New Zealand, the COVID-less capital of the world? Yeah,
they did it good.
They did it real good.
They did it very good.
Also guns. They did guns real good as well.
Also,
they don't have them anymore.
Correct.
Yes.
Before I dive into like this, what I wanted to talk about, which is the impact of this wine, because we talked so much about the impact of the Matrix, and it's why I chose this wine specifically. Like I think that the pairing, and we'll get to that, works in some ways synesthetically, kind of not in other ways, but really the big thing that drew me to this wine was the meteoric tectonic impact that this wine had on the world of wine. But just speaking about the wine in the glass, I think all of your tasting notes are perfectly cromulent.
I think they're a little better than cromulent, but okay. All right.
they are accurate.
Fucking nagging me here on my own podcast. Pretty rude.
I mean, the podcast might as well be called Negging with Scott and Jamie. Mm.
No. That goes near the bottom of the list of Jamie's suggested podcast titles. It's a pretty deep bottom.
I forget what was the one that I was really excited about.
Smellovision.
I still think it should be called Smellovision.
You should never name anything. If you ever procreate, I'm going to warn your future co-breeder that you're not allowed to suggest names for your children.
So the wine. The wine is super citrusy and tropical, exactly as you said. I think it's got passion fruit, it's got guava, it's got star fruit, it's got lemon juice rind pith, it's got lime juice rind pith, it's got big time like ruby red grapefruit, it's got...
But Jamie, I don't like grapefruit.
That's wrong, you're wrong about
but
that.
But I'm liking this wine.
Yeah, and it tastes like grapefruit.
But I don't like grapefruit.
It smells and tastes like grapefruit.
God damn it smells like grapefruit.
Yeah, you're goddamn right.
It's not just that I'm suggestible.
Because grapefruit is delicious, Scott.
Then why does it taste so bad,
Jamie? It doesn't taste bad. You're just a curmudgeon.
Jamie, lots of old people like grapefruit, okay?
I know that, which is why you should. Because what are you? You're in December, you're turning 112?
It'll be my 111st birthday. 111st birthday. All right, I'm sorry. I sidetracked you on grapefruit.
Again. Which is fine. It's funny. And grapefruit's delicious. And those of you who don't like grapefruit are wrong. Mm. And that's the way that goes.
I'm going to text Adrian right now. Anyway, go ahead.
She knows she's wrong.
Yeah.
It's okay. Another big flavor component of this wine that I think you missed, but which is indicative of Sauvignon Blanc and Bordeaux varietals generally, is like fresh cut grass, jalapeno, green bell pepper.
And that's one flavor?
That is a family of flavors that is the result of a chemical called pyrazine, which is present in the Bordeaux varieties, which are Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Carmenere, Malbec, Sauvignon Blanc. I'm missing one. Whatever. Cab Franc. That's the one. Cabernet Franc.
Everything is Franco-centric with wine.
Oh, yeah.
In the little bit of reading I did about these two New Zealand wines we're talking about today, everything was about, well, this region better represents Bordeaux varieties, and this region is better at Burgundian varieties. And it's like, yeah, man, can't we just come up with another classification for those groupings of grapes other than just the, you know, small French regions that produce them well?
This is a huge topic that would take a lot of time for us to unpack. And right. I'm certainly not like the leading or even an expert on it, but like this is a result of colonialism 100%. And the conception that France is the site of the best wine.
It's the birthplace of wine. Right. They invented wine. They perfected wine. All wine terminology shall derive from French words and French regions.
If historically wine had been made in England, which now it's starting to be, but if historically it had been,
right,
that would be our touchstone for,
right,
for wine. But because the British bought so much French wine, it's France. It's just a reflection of colonialism. And there's much, much more to say. And I'm trying to sort of decolonize my thoughts on wine, but it's really hard.
I mean, yeah, you just referred to all the varieties of grapes as
the Bordeaux varieties. The Bordeaux varieties. Man, it it's hard.
Well, what else is there a different
but
way?
But also, they are a family of grapes. Like they are related.
And what's the scientific family?
Parent-sibling relationships. Well, it's all the same species,
right?
And it's not a new subspecies, it's a variety.
Right.
So it's just described by parent-sibling relationships.
Wait, so is there no other grouping name like for that? There's no other classification for the Bordeaux varieties and the Burgundy varieties? No. It's not just that the French has like supplanted any like scientific nomenclature. They're only grouped by those two French regions.
That's right.
That's stupid.
I agree.
If I were a non-French speaker, I am, and a wine professional, which I'm not, so never mind. But that's stupid.
I agree.
Okay, great.
It's a difficult process that is ongoing. Anyway, pyrazines are present in all of these grapes.
What are those again? Those are the
that's the cut that grass, are, the oh, jalapeno, yeah, the bell pepper. Going so far as we have talked, I'm sure, and you've made fun of me, I'm sure, for a tasting note in some extreme versions of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc being cat pee.
Yes, cat pee.
Yeah.
Jamie loves cat pee.
I love cat.
Hashtag Jamie loves cat pee. Let's get that trending, everybody. Hashtag Jamie loves cat pee.
I am now going to just hashtag our posts with that.
You're
going
to have to, yeah. Whenever we're talking about a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc.
No, just all the time.
Hashtag Jamie loves cat pee.
Hashtag Jamie loves cat pee. Because all press is good press, Scott.
Oh, but the funny thing is that Jamie really does like cat pee. It's not even a joke.
Cat pee is among the worst smells in the entire world.
And yet, people love cat pee.
It's an easy way to recognize this thing if you're blind tasting. I don't think this wine smells like cat pee. I think the pyrazines in this wine are really restrained and well integrated. I think the reason that you didn't pick them out isn't a lack of tasting skill on your part. It's that they're really, really well integrated and they work well with the fruit flavors. It's more cut grass than it is cat pee. Sometimes it gets a little bit more extreme than that. Scott's got his skeptical face on. He's also got his holding back a Jamie insult.
It's just funny anytime you talk about cat pee as though it's not. Like, as though it's something you want to detect in your food. Like, you should be saying, like, oh, God. Oh, it's cat pee. Oh, the bottle's gone bad. Throw it out. But instead, you're like, yep, cat pee, just as expected. This is characteristic notes of this wine, and it's definitely a desirable thing. I totally want more. Yes, delicious cat pee.
Did you hear me say that it was desirable? I just said that it was typical.
Right. But like, you're not shocked. You're never horrified. You're never like, ah, you're not even like, oh, the cat pee smell is so bad. But then the flavors are so good. You're just like, yes, it's cat pee.
One of these days, you will accept and understand the idea that things that sound unappetizing in small quantities can be positive and complexing components. One of these days you'll get there.
I mean,
and when I say barnyard, you won't like snicker into your microphone. I
realize that most of my issues with these types of terms are when you use them uncritically, but specifically we're talking about terms that have their roots in animal waste products. Like barnyard and cat pee are the two big ones that are
there
so-
There are foods that you find delicious that have notes of barnyard, Scott.
Yeah, but I don't sit down and enthusiastically describe them and say, yes, the odors of mixed animal feces. Like, that's what you're talking about. You're talking about animal poo.
Yes, I'm taking apart the wines. I am striving to understand them on a deeper level.
All I am saying is you could meet me somewhere in the middle between my incredulous distaste for hearing food described as animal waste and your great enthusiasm for accurately describing animal waste flavors.
No, I'm not going to do that.
Just meet me somewhere in the middle.
Nope.
Where you can say, yes, academically and clinically, this is a cat pee thing. But then, you know what? I'm actually with you that it doesn't sound that fucking appealing.
I have said on microphone that it doesn't sound appealing. And that I know that it doesn't sound appealing.
All.
I have said it. I said it just now.
No, we're deleting that. That's getting cut out of the episode. if that's for sure. Anyway, this has been 10 minutes about cat pee.
10 minutes about cat pee.
This is our new podcast. 10 minutes about cat pee.
Okay. The wine is high acid. It's super duper bright. It's really intensely aromatic. It also has an incredible intensity on the palate. There's just a lot of flavor, a lot of aroma. There's a lot of this wine. You know, you open up a bottle of this and you can smell it from across the room. It's intense. Much like camping. Which is a very funny joke.
Extremely funny. Hilarious. You just sidetracked yourself there. I'm not responsible for that.
Yeah, I did that myself. Yeah. So let's talk about Marlboro. Now,
this is a region.
Yes.
But this is not an appellation.
It is an appellation.
But they don't call it that there.
They call it GI or a geographical indication.
Okay.
That is their legal terminology for it.
But in France, we would call that an appellation.
You would call it, well, their thing is AOP, Appellation d'Origine Protégée. In America, AVA, American Viticultural Area. In Italy, DOC, Denomination, d'Origine Controllata. Et cetera, et cetera, ad infinitum.
So it is an appellation.
Yes.
Because we have to use the French word for everything.
I mean, appellation is an English word.
Damn it. We have to use the word the French use for everything.
It's a cognate of a French word, for
sure.
All right.
All right. All right. So tell me about this region, area, designate, this place.
So prior to 1973, it was a place where they grew wheat and herded sheep. And that's basically it. That was the agricultural activity of the area. There wasn't a whole lot of other business happening there. And then in 1973, which, by the way, once again was 6 years after Prohibition in New Zealand, one of the bigger companies in New Zealand called Montana made a 2,900-acre purchase in Marlboro for the purpose of growing grapes. They took a gamble on the area. The president of the board believed that it was going to be the place that they could stake a claim and produce a lot of very good wine. So he went down there, purchased 2,900 acres for about 1.4 million New Zealand dollars. And in 2005, that same land was worth 235 million New Zealand dollars.
That seems like quite an increase in market value.
Yes.
Far exceeding inflation.
That is correct.
So this gamble worked out for them.
It worked out incredibly well. And they're like, even at $235 million, they have no intention of selling it. They're making tons of money by growing tons of Sauvignon Blanc on this land. From that purchase on, more and more companies began to come in and buy up more land. There was resistance from the farmers in the region who largely just got bought out. As you know, when big business does big business things, the little guy gets hurt. So now here we are in 2021. about 70% of New Zealand vineyards exist in Marlborough. They produce by far the most wine of all of the regions of New Zealand. And about 70% of those vineyards are planted to Sauvignon Blanc.
Wow. They're not really diversifying their product that they're putting out there.
Not at all.
No.
It's a massively successful product. And Cloudy Bay was a huge part of that success. John Honan, who was the proprietor of Cape Mentel, which was one of the first five producers in Margaret River in Australia, got in on the ground floor here in New Zealand and made a large land purchase in 1985. First vintage was 1986, and continued to grow and grow and grow until they got investment from LVMH, a noted luxury brand.
What does that abbreviation stand for?
Louis Vuitton Moet Hennessy.
Ah, whoa. Yeah, that's a super luxury brand conglomerate.
LVMH, which, among other things, owns Ardbeg, Belvedere, Domaine Chandon, Chateau Cheval Blanc, Chateau Dichem, Cheval des Andes, Clos de Lambray, Colgan Cellars, Dom Perignon, Glenmorangie, Krug. They also own Bulgari, Chaumet. They own Tag Heuer, Tiffany & Company. The list goes on, and they own Marc Jacobs. It's a giant luxury conglomerate.
Rich people brands.
Yes.
They got all them rich people brands.
The 80s were a pretty massive economic downturn generally for New Zealand, and yet Cloudy Bay and all of these other wineries continued to grow and grow and grow. And wine lists the world over began to show Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc on them. And the wines of Sancerre, famously the best French Sauvignon Blanc, tended to get a little bit riper to match the style of this wine.
Mm.
People in Napa tended to take oak off of their Sauvignon Blanc, choosing to try and emulate this style.
Because this is stainless, right? They do this in stainless.
Correct.
And that's the traditional Marlborough regional way of making Sauvignon Blanc.
I hesitate to say the word traditional,
right,
because
it's all in the last 50 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yes, you would be hard pressed to find much oaked Sauvignon Blanc in the area. And some of it does exist.
Why stainless? Why do they do stainless instead of oaked?
Stainless for a couple of reasons. First, economically, it's
way cheaper than French
cheaper,
oak.
Cheaper, reusable, easy to clean. No, like oak can get bacterial or fungal infections and make you need to throw it out or at least strip it. Also, when oak gets like super old, you just have to throw it away. Stainless steel lasts forever. Yeah.
What's the name of a barrel guy?
Cooper.
A cooper.
Yes.
You don't need to have a cooper on staff.
Correct.
I'm sure that's probably not why they made the decision. I just thought a barrel person had a more fun name than a cooper. I misremembered. A barrelier.
Nope. Cooper. It's also the quicker way to accomplish élevage, which is the aging of wine. Hmm. If you're using a barrel, you want to let it rest in the barrel for a while. Here, they just let it rest in the tank, and then when it's ready, pump it out, bottle it, good to go. Quick to market, no chance of bacterial or fungal infections. Well, lower chance anyway. It's much, much easier. Also, stylistically, no oxygen ingress, so you don't get oxidative notes at all. It's what they call reductive winemaking, or winemaking in the absence of oxygen. This deliberately doesn't give you oxidative notes, but also can preserve some sulfide compounds in the wine, which allow minerality to better express itself. That we're not going to talk about minerality more than just that.
But what if I want to talk about minerality?
Do you want to?
No, I just don't want you to decide all on your own what we're going to talk about. Okay. Maybe I want to talk about minerality.
Okay, but you don't.
No.
Okay, good.
All right.
Glad that
we have decided we're not going to talk about
minerality. We decided together we're not going to talk about minerality.
Excellent.
It also preserves fruit character in the finished wine. So stainless steel in this context is both a stylistic and a business measure. It is quicker to market, and also this is the product that they are trying to make.
Is that a big thing in, like, I feel like this is also a now dated and problematic term, but is stainless steel a big thing in emerging wine markets? Like, just from a cost factor, it's just easier to start producing with stainless?
Definitely. Yeah. It is you know, your initial investment on a stainless steel tank is more than one barrel for sure, or more than even the comparable volume in barrels. However, over the course of time, it will serve you longer and better, a stainless tank.
Excellent. Well answered.
You are welcome.
Thank you.
Where was I?
I don't know. That bathroom break really threw you.
It did.
You are not combobulated.
I'm not.
You need to combobulate yourself.
Maybe I just need more wine. Hold on. Pause for extra wine.
Pause for Jamie drinking.
God, it's really good.
It's got a lot. There's like a funk to it. There's like a little bit funk? Of like, yeah, there's like a, I don't know, maybe that's my way of interpreting astringency in a white wine.
You're talking about the texture of it?
Yeah, I guess it's a textural thing, but just something that feels, I don't know, when I this is presaging the pairing section, but when I was drinking it, watching with the movie, it was like all the fruit and the citrus and all the, you know, forward flavorful, tricking me into thinking there's sweetness notes of it were like the action and the thrills and the kung fu and all the like popcorn movie stuff. But then like the weird, unsettling, like sci-fi and existential stuff I was relating to, like what I was describing as a funkiness there. I think there's a funky note, even though I'm not smelling it, but maybe that's just texture. Maybe that's just like a back of a throat textural thing.
I'm not 100% sure to what you're referring. When you say funk, but I, you know, I think that there is a definite textural element to this wine. It sort of clings to your tongue on the way down.
Yeah. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. I feel like I'm getting an additional very round, not earthy, but like something akin to like the aftertaste of figs.
Huh. Interesting.
Like at the back of my tongue as I'm finishing a swig.
That's an aftertaste of figs.
Something akin to that. But that could all, yeah, that can, might just be astringency and I'm misinterpreting it as flavor, but
I think it's astringency. But for sure there is like there's a lot of complexity here. There's that textural element that's really interesting about it and sort of keeps you alert. And the acidity like really makes your mouth water too.
Yeah.
Like I said, there's a lot to this wine. Because it's so, the style is so pervasive, and it's like, go anywhere. You're likely to find a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc on the By the Glass list.
Right.
For sure, any chain restaurant, anywhere. But even higher end places will typically, just because it's an easy one to check the box off. Someone wants New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, it's easy to just have one. People like me will typically like try and find some other aromatic wine to fill the slot that is like more satisfies our like intellectual curiosity for wine. But this one in particular, the Cloudy Bay, just hits hard. This is fucking delicious. And that's one of the reasons why I was so tickled when I chose this wine to pair with The Matrix, because I think it's easy for us wine people to get caught up in the esoteric and get really excited and only excited about something that is tiny production from Slovenia made by, you know, some old grandma in the basement. Mm-hmm. And while I do very much respond to those stories.
You like your old grandma basement turlet wines.
I do, yes.
Yeah.
There's something to be said for something that is reliable, that is always on shelves when you're looking for it, and that's just delicious. Every bottle of this wine is delicious.
How mass produced is this? This is a lot, right?
Yeah, it's huge.
This is super ubiquitous.
It's certainly not the biggest New Zealand or Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc. Probably Kim Crawford is the biggest one.
I don't know her.
Him, actually.
Shows me.
That's right. Yeah, Kim Crawford is probably the biggest. That one was sold, I think, to Pernod Ricard, and they make it like so much of that wine. But this one is huge. There is a lot of it made, you know, millions and millions of bottles every year. And it's made by one of the world's biggest luxury companies that also makes Veuve Clicquot and Dom Perignon and Hennessy and Moët and all of those things. It fits squarely in this, like, I guess, accessible luxury camp. $36 is expensive for a bottle of wine. In my mind, it's very like standard, but I recognize that for most people who don't do this for a living, 36 is a lot of money.
That's an amount. Yeah.
But it's not outside the reach of most middle-class households. The same can be said for the Hennessy products and Veuve Clicquot and Moët. And that also is the larger story of New Zealand wine. And I'll talk more about that in our next episode. Mm.
Sneak preview for everyone.
Yes.
We're sticking in the NZ next time.
That's right. So you had a question about this wine. You had something you wanted to discuss.
I had a thought. I have a thought from time to time. For the listener at home, Jamie very thoughtfully provided me with some research materials because I texted him after our last episode and said, how do I find more thoughtful things to say about these wines? Because I'm running out of shit to say. And Jamie's like, I'll just start giving you research, which has been very helpful. The research that you provided for this one, I'm not actually referencing at all, of course. I read an article about Cloudy Bay from thedrinkbusiness.com. This is from their Asian version of this, like, I don't know, alcohol website, but like specifically rooted in Hong Kong, I think was where this article originated. And the headline is Cloudy Bay defies New Zealand shortage to release two new Sauvignon Blancs. This was like a few weeks ago this was written. And the quote here is, for the Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc 2021, the vintage has been challenging as the yield in New Zealand is low, but the fruit is intensely concentrated. They go on to say that the 2021 vintage, we're drinking the 2020, but the 2021 vintage is a fresh, vibrant wine with grapefruit, passion fruit, makrit lime leaf on nose, and layers of lime, lemongrass, and stone fruit flavors, according to the brand. But so the 2021 vintage, the yield is low, but the fruit is intensely concentrated. Why was the yield low? It seems like a lot of yields were low in New Zealand in 2021. And what does it mean for the fruit to be concentrated? Like, does it mean that they grew the grapes in closer proximity, or that the grapes themselves had like a more intense grape flavor?
Okay. So the two things that you're talking about are actually very related.
Okay.
If you're asking why the yield was low specifically in 21.
Yeah.
There was low rainfall is a large driver of that.
Is this a climate change thing?
I mean,
it's probably a climate change
thing. I am less intimately familiar with vintage variations in New Zealand than I am in America, because I live in one of those countries.
Right.
Not both. But I do know that there was record low rainfall in 2021, also in 2019 and in 2015 in Marlborough, which is already typically a very dry area, which is typically helpful for the wine growing process, because they don't ever have to worry about rot pressure. When there's less moisture in the air, less fungus grows on the grapes.
Wait, rot simply. Pressure? Is this different from fungal pressure?
It is fungal pressure.
It's the same pressure. Thing as fungal pressure. Okay, great.
Fungal pressure. Still your
I wasn't going to do it. I was giving you a little setup there. If I was going to do it, I would have done it. I was giving you a little chance for a callback there. All right. So low rainfall is good for less fungal pressure.
Right.
But too low rainfall.
Because they're plants and they need water.
Yeah.
That decreases the amount that you can yield. Now, generally speaking, lower yield increases quality. We've talked about this before. The less grapes a single vine makes, they can put more flavor compounds into each grape that they do make.
Yeah, you have higher quality control when you make fewer things.
Sure. Yes. But that's like, we're talking about a plant and not a person making these things. Wait.
When you say there's less, fewer grapes on the vine, that are you saying that literally there are fewer grapes growing on an individual vine strand?
Yes.
Not that they're using less of their plantable area to grow grapes.
Correct.
Means they're instead of having 100 grapes on a single vine, they're having 50 grapes on a single
That's
vine.
That's right.
What?
If the vine is experiencing water stress,
then you grow fewer grapes on it.
Right.
How do you do that? How do you make it grow fewer grapes?
Well, there are a lot of ways to, so growing extra grapes or growing a lot of canopy or growing a lot of leaves, this is called vigor. Uh-huh. And there are a lot of ways that you can manage vigor. One of them is by managing water stress. Another is by pruning specifically. And another is by planting in areas that devigorate vines. So like less fertile areas.
So they'll like prune off a proto grape bunch mass.
A bud.
I prefer my way better. But my way sounds more like a Dune pre-spice mass. Spoilers for Dune. just nothing. so they'll cut off a grape bud to prevent it from growing a grape so that the other grapes on the vine will get more of the nutrients and water and all the other things.
Yes.
I didn't realize that was a thing that they did.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I don't know why that's strange to me, but it is.
Yeah, you're like scratching your head trying to figure this out. There's just
so many elements to how the plants are weird and funky and dirty and get down in weird and uncomfortable ways to me, but then also all the ways that we control them. Mm-hmm. I am finding increasingly strange. Like it just never occurred to me that like, oh yeah, we could have 1,000 grapes on this vine, but we only want 200 of them. And so we'll just trim them off and we simply deny them then.
Right.
And I find that strange.
It is strange, but the result is more flavor compounds in each individual grape,
right,
which then translates into a more concentrated and flavorful wine.
Less grape, more flavor.
Right.
All right.
It gets a lot more complicated than that, but that's the basic gist of it. Anything more just gets tiresome to talk about after a while.
That is another great possible title for this podcast. the whole thing, it gets a lot more complicated than that, but anything more, it just gets tiresome to talk about.
Yeah.
All right.
That's what they mean by intensity, and that's the effect of lower yield. And in fact, a lower yield is one of the reasons why Marlboro was chosen by Montana in 1973. It's a very famously cold and low rainfall area with gravelly alluvial soils. So soils that would naturally devigorate these vines. And Sauvignon Blanc is famously a prodigious producer of grapes.
And you want things to devigorate a famously prodigious producer so that what you produce has more flavor but less grape.
That's correct.
Okay. Can you tell me about this other Cloudy Bay wine that is mentioned in this article? Because it sounded buck wild.
Te Coco. Yeah.
Which in this article on thedrinkbusiness.com, they say that it has an aromatic and savory profile with white peach, preserved citrus, and honey aroma, and citrus, rambutan, guava, and warm pancake notes on the palate.
Yeah.
Jamie, why am I not drinking the pancake wine right now?
Well, Te Coco is like $60 SRP.
That's too much.
It's really, it's very good. Wines? It's very, very good.
Are there other pancake wines?
So with the pancake note, what they're hinting at is oak. We talked about how there's not a lot of oak Sauvignon Blanc that gets made. Te Coco is one of the few, and they only make a little bit of it. It's an oak-aged Sauvignon Blanc. You know, the pancake thing comes from extra time on lees and then also time in oak. So you get that sort of like vanilla bean cinnamon character.
The baking notes exactly. Situation.
It's delicious. The first time I tasted it, I was over the moon about it until I was told that it was $60 SRP and that like if I were to buy it for the restaurant, then I have to charge, you know, minimum $120. But realistically, it has Cloudy Bay on it. So it's going to move fast. So it's got to be like, I don't know, 160 by the bottle. And I'm just not comfortable with that.
So tell me about the reputation of Cloudy Bay. Because again, we've talked about it. You were all giddy that you were going to be agitating the wine stands out there by somehow it would be an annoyance to them or.
I think
iconoclastic, yes. To pair this with the Matrix. But the rep of this winemaker of Cloudy Bay is very good and like not prestigious, but it's high end.
Yeah.
But the reputation is also good.
Yes.
This isn't like a Jamie's taking a stand and defending fucking Kendall Jackson Chardonnay. You're not linking.
No.
This is a good thing that people like.
No, this is a good thing that people like. I think the eye roll that comes from the wine stands out there is for Marlboro Sauvignon Blanc generally, because there's a veritable sea of it, yeah. Right? And it all tastes very, very similar. Of them, though, this one, I think, stands head and shoulders above. Mm. And it's partly because of their association with LVMH and resulting focus on quality over extreme quantity. That's the take here. Cloudy Bay has a very good reputation. It's basically the king of Marlboro Sauvignon Blancs.
Well, I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's super numbs.
It's also a story of like how market dominance can really skew the price of things. Mm. You know, do I think that this wine in the glass tastes like $36? I kind of don't.
Then why did we buy two bottles of it?
To do a podcast about it and say all of the things about it.
Oh. But if we had just had a glass of some other, let's say, $20 or $19 New Zealand Marlboro Sauvignon Blanc, would you have been able to tell the difference?
Yeah.
Would I?
No.
So what are we doing here?
Well, the wine part of this is for me. So
I think it's for the audience, Jamie. It's not about you. For the audience. This is a public
service. And also
it's
for the members of the audience who care about wine that would be able to tell the difference, whereas you might not.
That care about and wine.
Yes. I think that this does stand head and shoulders above a lot of other New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs, but its price continues to rise kind of ahead of inflation.
Mm.
And that's because of its name recognition. It's economics, baby.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
That's how it do, economics. All right. So you have strong feelings about this wine.
I think it's really good. I'm happy to be drinking it right now.
I'm happy to be drinking it as well.
I'm enjoying the hell out of it.
No one is challenging you. It's very good.
I didn't think anyone was challenging. I was restating that I am excited by this wine and I like...
Defensive. I just feel like you're...
No.
You're trying to fend off attacks that aren't coming. No one is mad at you for picking this wine, Jamie. It's very good.
Someone might get mad at me. I don't know.
This is just the world that you're living
in. No, I don't think anyone.
You're just gearing up for people coming out to disagree with you.
No, I feel like I didn't properly express how much I'm enjoying this wine and I wanted to restate.
Well, Jamie, I didn't properly express how much I'm enjoying your company and recording today.
Oh.
And I should say that now because we have a few hours more of it.
Oh my God.
But so you like the wine. I like the wine. Somebody else has takes about this wine though.
Somebody else.
There are.
Could this possibly be your wife?
It is true. There are wife takes. They are coming at you. Although, actually, mostly these wife takes are not about this wine.
Why is she like this?
Because she gets bored and she tries to do new things and she's having a good time.
Sure. Okay.
Why have we changed the format of this show three times with zero demonstrable results of those changes in the finished product?
This last one, though, the demonstrable change is our recording time. With the possible exception of this episode.
Yeah, we're fucking running long. Let's power through it. So, yes. Wife takes. Takes from the wife. This is a game recreating my wife Tani's favorite way to antagonize Jamie at his restaurants, coming up with absurdly pretentious and flowery descriptions of the wines that he served us to mock him and his delicate psalm sensibilities. Now, today we're doing something a little bit different. The first question, this is an ongoing thread in our It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Want Wine miniseries. In which way do you, Jamie, die in the machine uprising apocalypse of the Matrix?
I do like this particular thing that she's been doing the last couple episodes.
As do I.
Yeah.
So, Jamie, you have three options here, and you have to guess which way Tani predicts you will die in the machine uprising.
Okay.
Number one, you are killed in Matrix as an innocent bystander whilst the cool kids deal with the whole war against the machine situation.
Cut me deep.
That is the way I would die, by the way. Number two, you are willingly unplugged from the Matrix, but upon arriving in the real world, realize the only available wine is turlet wine and immediately kill yourself.
That's, yeah.
This is pretty dark.
Yep.
And number three, as a natural born citizen of Zion, you, Jamie, die in a heroic and self-sacrificing way for the good of your fellow Zionists.
Fuck you, Tani.
So without getting into it or blowing up a spot here or anything, if you're not familiar, Jamie has extremely strong feelings about the state of Israel, and the idea that he would ever be described as a Zionist is extremely funny, and he's making like this sour Like, I'd say it's a cat pee face, but he likes that. So I don't know. It's cat poop face. He's very upset right now.
I'm so mad.
So which is it, Jamie? How do you die in the machine apocalypse? Are you killed?
I kill myself because
of
there's
wine?
No wine other than turlet wine.
Yeah.
That's the answer.
Well, her answer is she thinks it's number one, but with an outside possibility of it being number two, turlet wine number two. That was a very good numbering, wife. But she says the true answer is, since you can't say for sure that you're not in the Matrix right now, probably you'll die from either gout or complaining about gout.
You can't die from complaining about gout.
I mean, I might die if you keep complaining.
Really? That would be great. I'll just keep complaining.
Oh, it's fine. All right. So next up, which late 90s early internet movie trope does this wine most resemble?
Oh, boy.
So this is one of her absolute favorite things, is the way that the internet is depicted in mid to late 90s movies. It's her favorite. Number one, people looking at code and being able to see what's happening within the program.
Okay.
Number two, information visibly zipping along a physical wire that connects a computer to, capital T, capital I, the internet. Number three, the charming notion that denying free access to information is a sure sign of someone being a bad guy. Which of these three late 90s early internet movie tropes does this wine most resemble?
I want to answer three because I like it the most.
So you think the answer is the charming notion that denying free access to information is a sure sign of someone being a bad guy?
Yes.
Yes. She says its answer is number two because this wine is arguably zippy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's inarguably zippy, personally. It's fair.
You guys have something to argue about, apparently. and then she has two open-ended discussion questions for us. One, and this is a recurring segment that I keep forgetting to make both recurring and a segment, which is, what wine is Cypher drinking in the Ignorance is Bliss scene where he's in the Matrix at the restaurant?
Ooh.
And I always want to make a point of asking you, what wine or what drink is somebody drinking, do you think? And then I never do, because I don't pay attention.
I think the easy money is on Napa Valley Cabernet.
You think that's what he's drinking with his steak at his fancy restaurant?
It's the 90s at the height of the economic boom of the 90s and at the height of Napa Valley Cabernet's explosion. They're in a steakhouse. People are wearing suits. It's fancy. And it's still America. So it's definitely not Bordeaux.
Yeah.
It's Napa Cab.
All right. I like that answer. And then, I don't know if we're going to include this, her second open-ended discussion question. In the movie, a character says, this is from Mouse's big monologue, maybe they couldn't figure out what to make chicken taste like, which is why everything tastes like chicken, or why chicken tastes like everything. Is our child's branding of regular old wine smell the wine equivalent of the chicken tastes like everything situation? Do the machines just not care about red wine? I think this is something new that I'm learning about my wife, is that there's an implicit bias in favor of we are actually living in a matrix like simulation, underwriting a lot of these questions presupposing here. That is very distressing. My wife thinks we're in a simulation. Oh no.
I mean, it would explain some things about how she handles herself.
Fascinating.
Yep.
All right. Well, I don't have time for that right now.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts about regular old wine smell being that chicken tastes like everything?
I don't think that chicken tastes like everything.
I don't either. I've never held with that.
Yeah. Chicken tastes like chicken.
Yeah.
Chicken doesn't even taste like turkey.
Yeah.
Chicken tastes like chicken. Other things don't taste like chicken.
I agree.
And similarly, red wines smell completely different from one another, and regular old wine smell is, I don't know.
Regular old wine smell, baby. Spoilers for our next episode, regular old wine smell. Regular old wine smell. All right, well, Jamie, I don't know. You got some of these questions right. This game is not really about that anymore. Let us talk now about the pairing.
Yes.
Of Cloudy Bay, Sauvy B, and 1999's all-time great masterpiece, The Matrix.
The damn Matrix. All right, Scotty, run us through the discussion points that you and I talked about when we were discussing this pairing.
We had a little preamble before deciding upon the pairing. And here's what I told Jamie about The Matrix and what I was excited to talk about. That The Matrix is still as exciting now as it was 22 years ago when it came out. It's transgressive. It's thrilling. Its power has not diminished at all. It broke the zeitgeist. There will never be another Matrix. It's about the end of reality. about our connection to the real world or our lack of connection to the real world. I made a mention about how the imagery of the rain in the first act of the movie is so much like a visual parallel to the falling Matrix code that we see throughout. The movie is brassy. There's a lot of green, although not on the recent 4K release. You motherfucker, stop recoloring movies, all right? Let them be the color they were. Leave them alone. There's a lot of direct symbolism. There's dynamism, and it's fucking kinetic as fuck. Those were the things I said about the Matrix.
It's a lot of things. Yeah. You had a lot to say about this movie.
Well, it's a pretty important movie, Jamie, and it's extremely good.
Yes, I agree. All right, so the things that I grabbed onto from that lengthy treatise that you gave me.
Hey, I kept out all the stuff about the 4K recoloration in the treatise.
Which I appreciate, well, although I don't think you yet. Had, yeah, you yeah, hadn't watched it at that point. The things that I took out of there to get to this wine were that it's transgressive, that its power has not diminished, that it broke the zeitgeist. And while for sure there are changes coming in the wine world, some voluntary, some not, there will never be another Cloudy Bay. Also, this wine, I think, is green, brassy, dynamic, and kinetic. There is a lot going on in the glass when you open this wine. I think in the same way that the brass in the score of The Matrix kind of pervades your whole being, this wine does a similar thing. And as I said before, this wine really changed the landscape of wine. Wine prior to New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc coming on the scene, everything was getting more opulent, more rich, more big and flabby and lower in acid. And this wine comes on the scene and is loud and aromatic and zippy and high acid and light bodied and just intensely drinkable. Great with food, but didn't need food. Like a really good cocktail wine, a good aperitif, a good food wine, just kind of hit every mark that it possibly could hit. And it continues to be on basically every wine list everywhere.
I think, as we have seen in the last few episodes, your pairings are conceptually spot on. I think you found what sounds like, and I don't know, maybe 10 other Psalms would say 10 other things about it, and they'd all say, Jamie's a fucking asshole.
No one says that. Everybody likes me.
Jamie, you're a but I'm not a Psalm. But yeah, all of these things sound right on with The Matrix. But what about the flavor? So like conceptually, we are in lockstep. For the people who are really tuned in and invested in, are these guys able to draw conceptual academic parallels between specific movies and specific wine bottlers? Great.
Well, yeah. And also we both of us like the meta text of movies and wine, right? Like there's so much more to talk about when you don't just look at what is on screen or what is in the glass. Yes. That's part of why I love wine, because you can sit there and enjoy this beverage and the flavors, while they don't have like a reflective connection to the story, you can then associate those flavors with that story. That's the thing that got me to make wine my career.
Was making meta-textual connections between was talking wine about and movies.
I was talking about the stories, man. I like the stories.
I know you like the stories, but I'm saying, but we've talked about this before. When you're working with a chef and you're trying to come up with pairings for the new menu he's working up,
yeah,
you guys aren't talking conceptually. You're talking about flavors.
Correct.
And temperatures and textures.
That's right, because those wine and food overlap in that way.
Right. So I'm saying, do we have any parallels or connections in the glass?
I think in the glass, the big parallel is the brassiness.
Yeah.
Is the volume.
Yeah.
Of both. This is very aromatic. It's very high intensity flavor on the palate. Similarly with The Matrix, there's a lot to it, and it invades your headspace.
Yeah. And it, I mean, like you were saying that there, it's a lot in the glass. You can smell it from across the room. Like the Matrix is, as my wife was pointing out earlier with disdain dripping in her voice, that The Matrix is not a subtle movie, right? No. It is very direct.
Yep.
Even if you're not picking up on philosophically what it's about, like narratively and emotionally and thematically, it's very clear.
And even philosophically, it's very clear.
It is. I mean, you can unpack a lot more.
Yeah.
One of these days I'm going to do it. Since the movies have been on DVD, there have been two commentary tracks on every movie. There's a commentary track with the Wachowskis. And in fact, no, there's three commentary tracks. There's one with the Wachowskis. There's one with key cast members and like the DP and the like visual effects supervisor. And then there's a philosopher commentary track.
Oh, that's cool.
Where they've had on like Cornel West and a couple of other like philosophers and social prognosticators to like talk about the themes and the predictions about the movie. But like for all of that, like it's very direct. It's very straightforward. Like it's a movie that is a specific metaphor for some people, but it can be appreciated and a lot of people can apply it to their lives or apply their lives to it. And it's just like, it just gives you what you want. Like, yeah, it's a heady sci-fi philosophical movie about how we're all facing our own, you know, inevitable commoditization by a machine-like or machine-like
the algorithm,
evil conglomerate or algorithm. But it's also like it's a kick-ass kung fu movie.
Yeah.
And it's a super rad sci-fi movie with like hovercraft spaceships and aliens. And it's got, or not aliens, and robots. And it's got mad shootouts and super cool action sequences. And the performances are all big. That's something I had kind of forgotten about having not watched it in a while. The performances are all big. And to me, that's like smelling the wine with the glass held right. 6 inches away from your face, right? Like Keanu and Lawrence Fishburne and Carrie Ann Moss, and especially Hugo Weaving. Like these are not small, naturalistic performances, no. You know? You know what I was studying a lot when I was watching it were the performances of the actors who are playing programs. And so like thinking specifically about Hugo Weaving and in particular Gloria Foster, who in the first Matrix, the idea that she's a program is like meant to be a big reveal in the beginning of like her only scene in Matrix Reloaded.
Yep.
And watching it again now, like maybe it's a happy accident or maybe they just had their mythology all planned out so well from the beginning, but you watch that performance and like, oh yeah, she's a program. But then what that makes me wonder is, and this is a tangent, but like, how do you direct that?
Right.
You're the Wachowskis. You're in rehearsals or like you're having early meetings and you're talking to Hugo Weaving and you're talking to Gloria Foster and you're like, so you're a computer program, but I basically want you to behave like a human being. But then there's all these weird notes and these like weird little eccentricities.
We're going to get tied up in this for a minute, but which is fine, I guess. But I agree with you on a base level that she does read like a program.
Yeah.
But I'm struggling to come up with a specific part of her performance.
I think what reads like a program about her is this could also, maybe this wasn't decided at that point in the making of the trilogy. And maybe it's just the actor looking at, I'm an oracle and I'm knowledgeable about the future. But like, I don't know, between the writing and the unflappable confidence of the character, I just had no difficulty. You know, like sometimes in a series of movies where like you can feel where something was retconned or a character reveal is like, all right, so great example, something we were just talking about, Star Wars, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like we don't find out that Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's father until the end of Empire. Spoilers for Empire Strikes Back, I apologize. But watching the first one, how much does that match up?
Right.
How much does that make sense? Or like how much does all of the backstory that Obi-Wan Kenobi is giving to Luke about his father and he was a pilot and he was the greatest ever and we fought in the Clone Wars, how much does that still make sense in light of what you've seen in the prequels, right?
Right.
This is one of those examples where like, whether it was a decision that was made later or not, like a big character reveal that happens later in a series is perfectly in lockstep with what happened in the earlier installment. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't have any difficulty imagining her as a program. And I think it's the writing. And I think it's just that, like, the confidence
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That's the through line then with Hugo Weaving also. Right. And with the other two agents, too, who get, like, two lines each. But, yeah. Like, they just have this surety of motion.
Yeah.
I'm down with that.
But anyway, yeah, I'm seeing what you're saying about the wine.
The counterpoint here, I feel like it was a good pair. I think it works. I like the brightness. I like the loudness. I like all of the amplification. I like the pulpiness of them both. But the counter argument, I think, could be that The Matrix requires a darker, more brooding red wine because it's a pretty dark movie in its subject matter, for sure, but then also just in its presentation.
Yeah. But then you run into the problem of, like, we talked about this with with, what was it, The Irishman and whatever we did right after The Irishman, where like The Irishman, like I would say, like from a non-wine person point of view, that the easy choice there would have been like a big dark red wine.
Right.
And you didn't do that. You did, what the fuck did you pair with that? It was something white.
It was not a Riesling. It was. Was it? Something. Wait, was it the Love Drunk Rosé?
Maybe.
No. Neither of us has.
It was the Love Drunk Rosé.
Okay. Got it.
But yeah, like, so this is like a dark, heavy, brooding movie. And I will say, I was watching Matrix Reloaded last night, and I had the last glass out of my bottle of the Malbec that we're doing next, of the mm-hmm. Decibel. And that went nicely together. But I don't know. This is all conceptual bullshit anyway, but it makes sense to me to go to play to the brighter notes in the Matrix, to play right. to the laughs and the, not joy, but like the sense of discovery and the thrills and the excitement of the action, than to play to the dark notes, because the dark notes, if you dig into them, are pretty fucking distressing.
They're very distressing. And if I got like a really dark, deep, like sanguine kind of red wine.
Yeah.
It might be a lot.
Yeah. I mean, that paired with Morpheus telling Neo, like, and that's all to turn a human being into this. And it holds up a fucking right. D battery, and then Keanu goes and vomits. Like, that is all very distressing.
He's going to pop.
Unsettling. Yeah, so good.
So good. Joey Pants is good too. His facial hair is working overtime.
Joey Pants' facial hair is insane in that movie. It is so crazy. It's like what Klingons have in a lot of Star Trek episodes. Like, especially like in the original series when they hadn't quite figured out what Klingons were going to look like. And so it's just like a bunch of dudes in like bronzer and like steel mesh shirts and then like bad goatees and or just the Joey Pants, the Cypher look.
Yep.
A thin mustache and like a small,
yeah, that's weird,
whatever soul that patch. Is. Yeah, soul patch situation.
But like a long soul patch that's like a line.
Yeah.
Weird. Anyway, yeah, I'm very happy with this pairing. I think it works. I think as always, we're going to struggle with synesthesia, but I enjoy both conceptually the idea of these two things being together and also experiencing them together.
Yeah. I think it worked nicely. I think if anybody was looking for an excuse to rewatch The Matrix, like, I don't know, maybe a new, you know, 15 years later sequel that just came out on HBO Max and in theaters 11 days ago from the release of this episode, people should, you know, maybe watch The Matrix and drink this wine.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, so we agree.
The
pairing works.
Yes.
I concur.
Now let's move on to double features. What's your double feature? What's the next thing that we're watching after The Matrix?
I mean, I don't know. Watch The Matrix Reloaded and then just like don't complain. And if you complain to me that The Matrix Reloaded, the big burly brawl where he fights 200 Agent Smith, looks like a video game, congratulations. That's the point. You got it.
Scott, you don't have to shout. It's I'm right here.
Also,
and there's a microphone right in front of your face.
The burly brawl is so outstanding. It's so
good. I've come around on it. I was one of the people that complained a lot about that particular scene.
Because it looks like a video game. Because it looks like a video game.
And
that's okay.
And it is a video game.
It's The Matrix, y'all. We're in The Matrix.
That's correct.
Yeah. No, if just like thematically, just like something rad that people should watch that is very much like in conversation with The Matrix, is watch Satoshi Kon's Paprika. Have you ever seen Paprika?
I have. And it's awesome.
It's bonkers.
It's so cool. And now I want to watch it again because it's been years.
So Satoshi Kon, he was one of the all-time greats, Japanese animation directors. Paprika was his fourth and final feature film before dying at the age of 40, which is like one of the great losses to the film world. I don't know. Ever. Like, this guy was just gearing up. He made four fucking masterpieces and a outstanding miniseries TV show called Paranoia Agent, which is fucking wild and crazy. But Paprika is like, what if The Matrix, but even weirder? And it's about a like government agency that tries to fight against dream terrorists that try and weaponize dreams and infect people with them. And it is bonkers and buck wild and gorgeous and has some of the craziest and trippiest imagery that I've ever seen.
And our hero is a therapist.
Yeah, well, yeah, she's a therapist and her dream alter ego named Paprika. It's great. If you haven't seen it, you should watch it. If you have seen it, watch it again. Perfectly in line with The Matrix, and people should check it out. Paprika.
Love it.
Great movie.
Absolutely love it.
What about A Second Glass, Jamie?
Second Glass, I think that you should stay in New Zealand for your Second Glass, but check out one of the other varieties that I think New Zealand does really, really well, which is Pinot Noir.
So not a Sauvie B.
Not a Sauvie B.
Instead, a Pinot Noir.
That's correct. A Pinot Noir. So there is a winery called Burn Cottage, which first of all is a really cool name.
That's a pretty good name.
Yeah. They are in central Otago, which is an area farther south than Marlborough on the South Island of New Zealand. And their just base Pinot Noir is super fucking delicious. It can kind of fool you into thinking that it's Burgundy if you're not really paying attention, but it's got really exuberant fruit. It's kind of a joy to drink. Ted Lemon, the very famous winemaker from Literai in Sonoma, is a collaborator with them and sort of brings his expertise to bear on this project. And I think it's excellent. So try it out.
Ted Lemon. Collaborator with Burn Cottage.
That's correct.
I like all of these names. I like Ted. I like Lemon. Anyway, Burn Cottage.
Yeah, Burn Cottage is
Pinot Noir.
Real good.
That sounds delicious. Do you have any of that?
I don't have any of that. Any of that that has ever crossed my hands has gotten quickly drunk.
You drank it right away. Yeah. Well, you've gotten quickly drunk.
I have not gotten quickly drunk. I've got a pretty good tolerance.
Yeah. Well, good is a relative
word. I've got a pretty high tolerance.
There you go. That's the one.
So, Scott, this being your miniseries.
Indeed, it is my miniseries.
You leading the miniseries and indeed. Me pairing along with you.
Indeed.
Why don't you tell us what movie we're going to be watching?
Well, continuing our, you know, slow 6-episode, 12-week descent into the deep pit of depravity that is my dread of the future, the undiscovered country. we're going from robot apocalypse / virtual destruction of all of our, you know, inherent nature of reality to alien invasion movie.
We love it.
We're checking another box. We're doing an alien invasion movie, and we're doing something that is not super popular, a movie that wildly underperformed when it first came out. I am speaking of one of my favorite movies. This is 2014's Edge of Tomorrow. You may also know the movie by the name Live, Die, Repeat. It was so poorly received by audiences and at the box office when it first came out that a few months later when it came out on home video and digital release that the studio just changed the name. They changed it from Edge of Tomorrow, which is admittedly a nothing
name. A very bland.
It is so bland name. And yeah. Tells you nothing.
It is the Wonder Bread of names.
To Live, Die, Repeat, which tells you something about the movie. It's Tom Cruise. It's Emily Blunt. It's an alien invasion time loop war action sci-fi Looney Tune. Tom Cruise plays a military officer who ends up on the front lines of an invasion of Europe to stop this, you know, alien invading force. And he both dies in the invasion and then is given Groundhog Day-esque time loop controlling powers through which he, in a video game like progression, goes from being a greeny noob on the beaches of, it's actually set on the beaches of Normandy, to by the end of the movie, he has played at, you know, insane high difficulty a million times and he is godlike in this battlefield. And Cruise is genuinely fucking great. And Emily Blunt rules in it. And yeah, not a lot of people saw this movie. And I think the Tom Cruise of it all is a big problem, which we'll have to get into. It is available at present on any of your regular VOD rental services. Edge of Tomorrow. Live, no. Die, Repeat.
Yeah.
It's a good movie.
It's a good one.
It's a super good ass
spoilers,
movie.
I like it.
Spoilers, Jamie liked it because it's good. So James, what are you pairing with the sci-fi action time loop comedy hijinks of Edge of Tomorrow?
So we're staying in New Zealand, but we're heading up to the North Island of New Zealand, a little area called Hawke's Bay, an even smaller area inside that called Gimblet Gravels. This is the Decibel Malbec. You can find it at wine.com for $25 plus shipping. It's made by a Philly boy. It's a super delicious wine. This guy has a really fun story, and it's a whole other prism on New Zealand wine, which is, you know, the stuff that I normally am drawn to, the smaller production, artisanal kind of stuff. It was fun to dip into the big boys for a minute, but I'm happy to go back to someone with a much more specific and idiosyncratic point of view.
Also, it's super nummy.
It's very delicious.
Yeah, I opened the bottle and then I texted Jamie and I was like, yo, this decibel. And then Jamie's like, it's great, right? And I was like, Yo.
That's literally
that's how
the text message went. And yeah. I wanted to interrogate him further, but then I decided not to.
We gotta save it. We gotta save it for the recording.
Save Jamie. It for the microphone.
That's right.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. Please remember to follow us on all the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. And maybe tell a friend about it.
Tell a couple of friends. Tell all of them. They'll like it. This episode, as all our episodes are, was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That is me. And our social media presence is thanks to the illustrious James Jamie Harrison Rubin III. That's him sitting right across from me.
Remember, everyone, please drink more wine, watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
Yeah, I got nothing else.
That's the end.
The episode's over.
Wrap it up.
Good night, everybody.
Goodbye.